Thank you very much. Thank you, Peter and Susan and everyone at Codex for inviting us. Can you all hear me? Do I have to scoop down?
You have to push the microphone up.
Up? Like that?
Yeah.
Can't I just bellow?
Yes.
Okay. Fair enough. There's so much equipment on this thing, I don't know where to put my notes, but if something goes wrong, it's because of my papers. Pericles has been an issue in the press for about 10 years, so long, in fact, that many people are asking whether it's already gone to college, I think. It's a large project for us, the largest we've done, really, and there's a great deal of it that we haven't time to talk about this morning, which in any case doesn't have to do with the book as it now stands, but with all the preparation toward the book, especially having to do with the editing of the text. This is a new edition of the text of the play, which is notoriously corrupt, the original one, not my edition. The original one, the 1609 quarto, is full of errors, and every editor since, and there have been many, has struggled with various problems there. I struggled with them too, with the help of those editors, and with the reference particularly to the original quarto. But our principal view in doing this edition was to create an edition of a play which is not well known. Even people who are Shakespeare aficionados often haven't been able to see it and often haven't even read it. It nevertheless is to us one of the most entrancing of Shakespeare's plays. It's one of the romances, the late group of four plays, Winter's Tale, Tempest, Cymbeline, and Pericles, which have a very special place in Shakespeare's work. We've always loved it. I've acted in it twice, directed it, written music for it. I've lived with it, in other words, for many years, and often wondered why it wasn't done more often. So we finally decided to do that as our first, we think, Shakespeare play. We'll probably do some others. The idea we had was to create an edition of the play which would be seamless for the reader. That is to say, you wouldn't constantly be faced with footnotes, with double columns of six-point type, you know, on bad paper, with the problems of act and scene divisions and all sorts of extraneous stuff coming into the text and getting in the way of your reading of it. So we tried right from the very opening of the book to get the action flowing, rather in the way that films now usually work, with the credits and so on running over the action. The action begins as soon as the film comes up and the credits are interposed for the first few minutes. We've actually started at the bastard title, the first printed page of the book, with, if you see the calligraphy in the middle there, "Enter Gower Who Speaks," the first stage direction. And as you proceed through the prelims of the book, you can see that this carries on through. To sing a song that old was sung, from ashes ancient Gower is come, and this is the title page, which sets out everything else. And in the second colors, this text runs right through. Here we have the next page. Assuming man's infirmity is to glad your ear. This is the opening of the characters in the play. And please your eyes. Now this is where the text actually begins for the play, on the recto there on the right-hand page. So as you've moved through these pages, you've seen this constant run of a line of calligraphy through. And as you can see, if you can read it, I hope you can, as you can see, the calligraphy on the left actually runs into itself on the right, and "please your eyes" is the end of the line facing the calligraphy. And if you go to the top of that page on the right, the play starts again. So you can actually go through the prelims, open that page, and start reading the play. But we wanted to have that sense of everything moving and the preliminaries being, as it were, stuck into the interstices rather than in any sense interfering with the reading. As the play goes on, there are many different locales, and it's sort of a picaresque play, really. It takes place in several locations around the Mediterranean, not geographically particularly exact, but well enough for the purpose. And if you can see on the right-hand side here, the characters of the play in Antioch, in Tyre, in Tarsus, and so on, each of these is done in colors, which are then picked up later in the book, as you'll see in some other pages, as introductions to the scenes. So it's a kind of a color location event device for people reading the play to keep you geographically intact so you don't end up drifting around in the middle of the Mediterranean wondering where you are. The first part of the play, which moves finally into the text type that we're using, which is Polyphilus at the lower part of the page, goes on with the first part of the rest of Gower's chorus. John Gower, the poet, who was 200 years earlier than Shakespeare, was brought into this play by Shakespeare as a chorus, as an old poet, to sing a song that old was sung. Because Gower, in fact, in his Confessio Amantis, wrote a version of this story, and it was one of the sources that Shakespeare used for his narrative in the play. Once we get past this initial thing, we have, in effect, a fanfare of trumpets and a big opening of the curtain, and this is the opening of the first scene of the play, Antioch. I won't, unfortunately, have time to tell you the story, which is a wonderful one, and in any case, we don't have all the slides of every page up here, but this opening with Antioch in bright orange and so on is intended, as I say, to be a kind of a fanfare, a great opening to the play. Now, in the process of preparing the text, going back to the preliminaries of all this, it was necessary to use a great many reference books, and I thought it might be interesting for you to see the kind of things that I had to deal with. Ben Crystal's book on Shakespeare's words, the glossary, several editions of Pericles, different editors, a good dictionary. We also have the complete OED, which the 20 volume one, which I had recourse to many more times than even I would have supposed. And of course some Jerry Mulligan, which is necessary to, you know, to get along. You have to have some music to play. Come on in.
Yeah.
I'm never bothered by people who come to listen to me.
Debbie? Deborah?
Yeah. And the typescript that I worked from, of course, ended up being amended continually as I was going along. Half the time I would change things in the stick, not in the text necessarily, but in the notes that I wrote for the text. I haven't mentioned that the play, as presented to you, as you'll see it at our table, you heard that? As you will see it at our table, is two volumes. The second volume consists of essays by Simon Brett, who did the wood engravings for the book, and Jan will be talking more about him, and by me on the notes and the text and all the rest of it, and notes on the text as well. But as you can see, there was a great deal of rethinking right through the whole process of the play. Now, as I mentioned, as we move the story along, we have the location titles in the margins and the shoulders, usually at the top of the page. There's Tyre, which is where Pericles comes from. Here we have Ephesus on the recto up there. There are a number of quick shifts in location, and not only in location, but also in style of verse and in style of illustration. And I wanted to talk a little bit about the way in which we, Simon and I, in laying out the openings of the book, tried to keep the narrative moving. And one of these ways was the rhythm, visual rhythm of the illustrations, which are often interposed into the text. So that, for example, in this sequence of pages, you have this diagonal block coming down with the fisherman down here in the lower corner with his net, calling out to the effect that he's got something caught in his net, which Pericles has been shipwrecked. He's washed up on a beach, and these fishermen encounter him. The fisherman, just as Pericles is trying to explain who he is, calls out that he's got something caught in his net, and it turns out to be Pericles' armor. Fortunately, of course, these things happen in these stories. And the way we decided to stagger these bits of armor down through the page, and then have the one on the lower right showing Pericles going off with the fisherman, it was my intention to create a kind of a visual counterpoint so that you had the text running this way.
No, I'm sorry.
Turned
the lights down finally.
Oh, good, good. So they had we have the text running vertically and we have the illustrations flowing through. So you get a nice, I hope, kind of tension, a counterpoint of movement through the pages. It's all very well for you, but I can't see my... No, it's all right. I can look at this and I can see everything. Here we have another one of the locations, Mytilene. Now, just to whet your appetites a bit, the heroine, Marina, is kidnapped by pirates. Again, these things happen in these stories. And she's taken to Mytilene and sold into a brothel. Now, you'll see the sign of the brothel up there at the top of the page, of course. It's fairly obvious even to the meanest intelligence. And here we have on the left one of the young ladies who works there. And the chickens, I have to say, are an interpolation from Simon. There's a line in the play somewhere where the bawd, the woman who runs the place, is talking about not having enough chickens, C-H-E-Q-U-I-N-S, which was an item of currency in those days. And Simon thought a visual pun on chickens would be good because business is very bad for them at the moment, largely because Marina won't have anything to do with the customers, being a virgin. And so probably a chicken in the pot, you know, occasionally would be a useful thing to have. So anyway, the chickens arrived as a consequence of that. On the right, you have Marina being brought in to be sold by the pirates, and in the gutter, both metaphorically and actually, you have the pander and the bawd, the two people who run the whorehouse. Janet will talk a little bit about the little ochre-colored engravings that follow along up there, I think. I will, because here they are. Yes, they can carry on. Here's another couple of the girls here. A statue of Hermes with a prominent physical attribute, which was common, apparently. If you go to Pompeii, you will see such statues. And in Pompeii, as you may be aware, you may not always admit it, but you may be aware that there are frescoes all around what was the brothel in Pompeii, showing what was on offer. And we have this happening here as well. These little ochre things are a series. Simon, it has to say, was blushing slightly, I think, as he engraved most of these. And he wrote a rather wistful note at one point, or maybe perhaps it was in a telephone call. He said, "Are they filthy enough?" those of you who know Simon will recognize the tone of voice. And we assured him that they were. In fact, a couple of them were surprising even to me. But then Simon's English, so. Here they carry on. Well, you know, they're imaginative. They had colonies. They could try this stuff out. These go on through the rest of the brothel scene. I wanted to show you this simply because there are some pages in the book which are effectively undecorated, without, not too many, but without any kind of engravings. This is the basic text grid. We have a very large foot margin, as you notice. It's done on the usual way of 1 to 2 to 3 to 6, 1 to 2 to 4 to 6, rather, going from the gutter around the page. We liked the air around it, and it did also provide Simon with the opportunity to put a certain number of engravings down into the gutter a little bit, so that we had much more movement around the text block than we might otherwise have had. So that's the basic grid for verse. This is, of course, one of the other issues with the play, that it's very at no point, in fact, is it a solid block of type in prose. Never. The second volume is entirely that, but this isn't. So with the verse moving in and out and the speaker's names brought out into the margin, there's an interesting kind of a rhythm to the text, whatever you do, even if you have no photographs, or no engravings, rather. Here we have a page of prose. This is part of the fisherman's scene. In Shakespeare, generally, the working class people, the lower class people, speak in prose, and the upper class in verse. So in the fisherman scene where you have prose, I did run the prose ragged right, because I didn't want to have too much of a contrast on the right side between the verse and the prose. But I asked Simon to do a block which would accentuate the upper right corner of the grid, so we still had that in mind. I think it's very important for the reader, as he moves through a book, or she moves through a book, to see, to have that same level all the time with the eye, and to have a consciousness of the active part of the page. It seems to me a useful thing from a point of view of design, to make it reader-friendly, as it were. So we have that squared-off block there. These are the sketches for the layouts that Simon and I used. This is the sketch for one of the big sort of set pieces in the book. If one were doing an opera of Pericles, this would be one of the big scenes. A storm at sea where Pericles' wife has given birth to a child and has apparently died in childbirth. Pericles standing on the deck, screaming at the elements, rather like Lear, actually, in the Heath scene. It's kind of a parallel scene. Screaming at the elements to stop this and calm down. So this is a sketch that Simon originally did with a lot of conversations back and forth by telephone. My problem was to figure out a way to fit the text that was available to me on that page, because don't forget we had planned ahead to where what text would be in every opening, so that it accentuated the drama of the moment. And to my mind, having been involved in productions of this and of Lear and other scenes where there are storms, there's always the problem for the actor being heard above all this noise that the sound effects people seem to love to promulgate. So this is what I did. This use of this second typeface, which is Jim Rimmer's Dunsing type. It's a titling face, which Jim did in several sizes. He died a year ago, and unfortunately never got to see this book in its full form, but he did see some earlier layouts and was very much interested with the way we'd use the type. It marries beautifully with Polyphilus and with the calligraphy which Andrea did, so it worked well. Anyway, I tried in this to build the rhythm of the scene and the volume of the poetry, as it were, in such a way that it would fit, and had it squeezed between these two large engravings so that there was a sense of effort in getting through the text. One of the things that I liked very much, I don't know if You can see it from where you are. Way down in the right-hand corner there, there's a little note from Simon, very wistfully. He said, can you bend this? Asking about the type. He was wondering whether I might be able to do something on a curve, you know, that would give a sense of, because he wanted to do some curving lines from waves or something. It didn't work out that we could. I have some circular furniture, and I tried, but it looked a bit cheesy, so I didn't end up doing it. So anyway, there's what came from that. Now, at this point, I'm going to turn things over to Jan, who will talk to you in more detail about the blocks and her part in the printing of the play. She is, by the way, one of two collaborators, Simon being the other. And I just want to thank her publicly, because I've thanked her privately many times. But Jan is, I say this quite dispassionately, a really superb printer. And what she's done, and Simon would agree, what she's done with this book is really astonishing. I do urge you to come and look at the press work. It's wonderful.